Let me begin this section by letting you know that this is intended to be an electronics engineering course for the layperson. I don't expect you to memorize a lot of useless formulas. I won't say useless, but I try to provide memory tools whenever possible that get around having to memorize a lot of silly facts. I don't expect you to know an awful lot of math. However, there are certain things about mathematics that you should know about, and I will make you aware of them whenever the time comes. I try to avoid the actual particulars of calculus, although some of the concepts in calculus and what it accomplishes are useful. That's later, much later. Most of what you need in the way of trigonometry can be accomplished by vector algebra, and so I make it as simple as possible where I can. The pie chart is one of these tools. The pie chart is incredibly useful. I suggest that you print the thing. If you don't like the version of it that I've got, it's rather small, it's rather low resolution. You might be able to print it, but there are better ones out on the internet that are like full-page pictures that you can print. Not to mention the fact that you go to surplus stores and they Xerox these things all the time. You can pick up poster-sized ones of these sometimes if you happen to be in the right surplus store. They sell them at ham fests and other places where people trade electronic gear. It wouldn't hurt to spend some time at a ham fest and get to know some of the people that are there. Some of them can give you some really good insights into where to pick up information on electronics. Most of the people that show up at ham fests have a background in electronics that's sort of technical, but they don't get into the heavy-duty electronics part of it. The early days one of the things required of a ham operator was, in order to get the license, was to basically come up through the ropes and learn electronics. So a lot of them are really knowledgeable. Also, operatives in surplus stores tend to be fairly knowledgeable. This is not true of Radio Shack. I have heard people joke about the notion that if they ever discover that one of their employees in Radio Shack is knowledgeable about anything, they find a way to fire him. I don't believe that's true, but it's sort of a joke. But that's the impression you get talking to them. So print the chart. Put it up on your wall in your workroom where you're trying to learn this stuff. Wouldn't hurt to paste it to the inside liner of a book or something that you use for reference material. Anyway, the second one probably isn't all that important to print, but it does serve nicely as an illustration. That's the one that I show for a resistor. Resistor wattage, which isn't shown in that picture, is kind of a difficult thing to specify, short of giving you all kinds of pictures, which I didn't think that was really warranted. Resistor wattage is a thing that's brought about by the limitation of the materials. Wattage itself, energy that you pump into the resistor, whenever you put voltage across a resistor and it draws current, voltage times current gives you wattage. And that wattage is heat that's being pumped into the resistor. Now, heat is different than temperature. People tend to equate them as the same thing, but they're not. Whenever you pump heat into a resistor, if there was some way to prevent that heat from leaving the resistor, if there was some way to absolutely keep the heat, you know, from leaving, 1 watt of heat would ultimately raise the temperature just higher and higher and higher. It has nowhere to go. In the case of a light bulb, this is pretty close to the ideal. Whenever you put power into a light bulb, the temperature on the filament rises almost limitlessly, because what happens is there's a vacuum around the filament. There's nothing to carry the heat off. There's no air. And since there's no air, no molecules for the heat to escape into, the temperature of the filament rises to the point that the filament begins to glow and incandesces. It gives off light, and it becomes radiant energy then that's leaving the filament. The heat has to get off somehow, and that's how it leaves the filament wire, as it turns into light. Light extending all the way down into infrared, of course, which you can't really see, but a lot of it's given off as visible light, and so that's how a filament glows. In the case of a carbon comp resistor, carbon composition is what that's referring to. Carbon comp resistor consists of a phenolic body, and it's relatively conductive of heat. Not great, but it works. And a carbon rod going through the middle, two metal buttons that are pushed up against the carbon rod, because you can't really weld carbon. They're pushed up against the carbon rod by the body, the phenolic body that holds the thing together. If you're a manufacturer of carbon comp resistor, and you're going to make, a bunch of them, you need to specify that the person that engineers your resistor into their product doesn't make the resistor, or doesn't pump more wattage into the resistor than it can withstand. And since the resistor is bathed in air, you make the assumption that they're just going to, wire it into a circuit and that there's going to be air in there. Since the resistor is bathed in air, there are coefficients that will tell you, as an engineer of a resistor, how much heat will be drawn off into the air. This will limit the temperature with a given wattage. So whenever they apply a certain amount of wattage to a certain physical size resistor, the size of the resistor, the surface area on it, is giving heat energy off into the air around it at a given rate, and that's what stops the temperature from climbing forever. Okay, so it comes down to this. If you're going to design a resistor, you don't want the resistor getting so hot that it breaks down the phenolic that holds the thing together. You don't want the temperature cycles to be so severe that they cause little fissures and cracks within the carbon. These things cause the resistor to be unreliable, and so you're caught between wanting to give the person as high a wattage rating as they can to give them more freedom to engineer your resistors into their product. But on the other side of the equation, you don't want to make the resistor so large that they don't want to use it, not to mention that it costs more to build a bigger resistor. So those are the two extremes that you're caught between if you're going to try and manufacture a resistor. Basically, all carbon comp resistors elevate to the same temperature given the wattage that they're rated for. If you run a resistor above its wattage rating, that will cause the resistor to break down before its reasonable lifespan. Running a resistor at 1.2 times its normal watts, and it's 20% over its wattage rating, will probably reduce its life by a factor of 10. I don't know the exact numbers, but it is severe. In the case of running a resistor over the wattage, say you have an application where you need a 1-watt resistor because you're going to pump 600 milliwatts into something, and a half-watt resistor, a 500-milliwatt resistor, won't do. In a pinch, if you could find a way to leak the heat off of the resistor, you could do it. You could get away with it, and it wouldn't really degrade the resistor over time either. but you've got to do a good job of leaking the heat off. If you bend the resistor down to where it makes contact with the chassis and squirt some of this heat conductive grease that they use to carry the heat off of semiconductors, it's sort of this white pasty stuff. You squirt some of that down in there and kind of, you know, smear it up against the body of the resistor and against the chassis. As long as it makes contact like that, it will carry the heat off of the resistor into the chassis. And even though you're dumping maybe 600 milliwatts into a 500 milliwatt device, the heat gets carried away and everything is happy. So that gives you some idea of why resistors are a certain size. Now, to identify the size of those resistors, I can give you some general guidelines. A 1-watt one watt carbon comp resistor is about 3/16 of an inch in diameter. Get out your ruler, hold your fingers, spaced apart about 3/16 of an inch so that you can kind of visualize this, and then imagine your finger spaced apart about 3/4 of an inch. Okay, the 3/16 is the diameter. The carbon comp resistor is usually a round cylindrical device. At least the body of it is. The wires come off of the ends of the cylinder. And the body is about 3/4 of an inch long for a 1-watt resistor. Half-watt resistor, it's 1/8 of an inch in diameter and about a half inch in length. A 1/4-watt resistor is about 1/16 of an inch in diameter and they're about 1/4 of an inch long, at least the body of them is. And going the other way, 2-watt resistor is carbon comp is about 5/16, a little larger, but certainly not 3/8 of an inch. And they're almost an inch long, maybe 7/8 of an inch long. The rare one in this is the 4-watt carbon comp resistor. It's the same diameter as a 2-watt, but it's twice as long. In other words, all you're trying to do is you're trying to carry heat off into the air. That's what counts. And so that gets you that. There's another way, as a manufacturer, that you can make a resistor smaller and therefore be able to fit into things better. You can let the temperature go higher. But if you let the temperature go higher with the materials that are used to make a carbon comp resistor, it won't work. The temperature will degrade the material. However, if you change the material, you use wire instead of carbon. You use nichrome wire, to be specific. This is the same kind of stuff they use in your stove for the heater, or the heater in your coffee pot, or the wires that glow in your toasters. This is nichrome wire. It's a metal that whenever it gets hot doesn't react very well with the free air around it. It doesn't oxidize terrifically bad, and so it will withstand high temperature and remain useful over a long life that way. They weld the ends of the nichrome wire to the metal posts that leave the device, the lead wires. They use ceramic to hold the whole thing together. This particular ceramic that they choose is not just happenstance. It's a ceramic that's intended to be good at heat conduction, so they can carry the heat off. A lot of times, they don't stop there. They drill a hole down through a long aluminum extrusion of some kind, and they put the whole assembly. They pour the ceramic while it's still liquid into the assembly, and so now the metal resistance element is now safely anchored inside of a metal device. So now the heat goes off to the metal, and the metal then carries the heat out from there. The metal usually has little mounting ears on the side, you know, with holes in them, so that you can mount this thing down to a chassis. When you mount it down to a chassis, it carries whatever heat is generated in the metal out to the chassis itself, and that's how you keep the heat off of the element inside. Doing all these things, you can have a resistor the size of a 1-watt resistor. that will handle 5 watts of power. So the problem of trying to identify a resistor when you see it on the shelf, unless someone tells you where the box that it's in says these are 5 watt resistors, for instance, is you have to identify the technology by looking at it. In other words, how is it made? What's its construction? And then from there, you get used to the different size resistors that are a certain wattage for a given technology. You'll see these things hanging on the hang tack. Hey, if you're in Radio Shack and you want to get yourself acquainted with them, look at some of their resistors. You'll see 5-watt resistors that are wire-wound types that are made of ceramic. You'll see half-waters and so forth. When you're in the next time you're in a surplus, you get a lot wider range of stuff in a surplus than you do a Radio Shack. They only carry the stuff that they figure most people are going to buy, and it's going to move off their shelves fairly quickly. In a surplus store, they get stuff from all over, you know, and they buy at a dime on the dollar or less, sometimes a penny on the dollar. And so they get a larger selection of different kinds of resistors and so forth. So you should try and acquaint yourself the next time you're in an Army surplus store, or electronic surplus store, or whatever, with the different things that are out there. And usually the operatives in surpluses are pretty bright. They go to the trouble to label the drawer. Unfortunately, a lot of times, customers, you know, pick up a resistor, carry it around for a while, decide they don't want it, and drop it in a nearby bin. That always makes things real confusing. But the operatives at the front counter are usually pretty bright. My experience has been they can identify a component just by looking at it. Companies tend to stamp on carbon comp, they use color bands, but on the wire wound resistors, they have large flat surfaces on them. They're easily stamped. The machine stamps the resistance value and the wattage value, although sometimes they're a little cryptic in how they do that. So you'll get used to reading them after you see a few of them. Another thing they tend to do is put factory serial numbers and date codes and things like that on the resistors. That's meaningless. Well, it's not, but for your purposes, it probably is. So that might give you some guidelines on how to tell how many watts a resistor is. When you're repairing a piece of equipment, you have to be able to judge by looking at the device how many watts it is if you're going to try and replace it. So, okay, on to bigger and better things. Color bands. The resistor that I've shown in the picture with the color bands on it, I don't tell you what wattage it is. The colors reading from left to right are blue, which has a numerical value of 6, red, which has a numerical value of 2, green, which has a numerical value of 5, and gold, I know it's yellow, just imagine it's gold. Gold has a tolerance figure of 5%. If it were silver, it would be 10%. If it wasn't even there, no color at all, it would be 20%. I'll get to the meaning of percentages later in this discussion. This is a similar system to scientific notation. If you're familiar with scientific notation, you know that proper scientific notation says you have a digit in the mantissa, and then a decimal point, and then however many more digits there are of precision, followed by times 10 to the power of, and that times 10 to the power of, that number is the exponent of 10, then that's the way scientific notation normally is displayed. This is a variation of that. The first two digits don't have a decimal in between them at all. They are just taken as is, digit, digit. And then the multiplier, the third band is the multiplier, what's called a multiplier. It is the number of zeros to add to the figure that you've come up with the first two digits. That seems like a pretty simple approach. It does have its roots in scientific notation, but for your purposes, that's probably not you need to understand that there's a difference between true scientific notation and the way that they code resistors. Okay. So this particular resistor is the digit 6 represented by blue, the digit 2 represented by red, and 5 represented by green. But it's not the digit 5, it is 5 zeros. So the whole number is 6,200,000. That's an awkward number to work with. So we have this thing called engineering notation, in which the way you would state that is, well, it's 6.2 megohms. Engineering notation works with powers of 10 to the nearest third, or the nearest three. Examples are 10 to the third is K, or K ohms, or whatever you want to call it. 10 to the sixth is megohms. Going the other direction, 10 to the minus third is milli, and to the minus sixth is micro. 1 microamp, for instance, is 0.000001. That gives you 1 milliamp is 0.001. 1 k ohm is 1,000 ohms. 1,000. A megohm is, of course, 1,000,000 ohms, and so they go in both directions. At some point, I'll give you a table of the actual names that they assign these things. Incidentally, you've heard of computer speak. They talk about kbytes and megabytes and gigabytes and things like that. This is different. The computer ones are based on the number 1024 and multiples thereof. That's 2 raised to the 10th power. They don't use even, 1,000 or 1,000,000 in computer speak. And that causes all kinds of confusions in the real world, because of the fact that K means one thing sometimes and K means something else other times. I just thought I'd mention that so that you understand that there is a difference and you don't get too easily confused. Okay, moving right along, the tolerance band. Why do we have a tolerance band? Again, if you're a manufacturer and you are making resistors by the millions and you've got this, you're going to make, 4.7 K ohms. And so you've got, you're going, whenever it gets to the end of your assembly line, you're going to paint a yellow band, a violet band, and then a red band on there to make 4.7K. And then you're going to paint on a tolerance band, why? Well, let's say you've got shifts that weren't work around the clock, and this particular week, for whatever reason, the chemicals weren't quite right. Your phenolic isn't as strong as it should be. You don't know why. Maybe the people that you buy your chemicals from, maybe you've got a contaminant getting into it someplace. But for whatever reason, something in the process doesn't quite give you what you need. And so you're not making 4.7 K ohm resistors. Some of them are, 46,900, something like that. Yeah, 4,690 ohms. Some of them are 4,710 ohms. They vary a little bit as they come off the assembly line. This is to be expected. Tolerances are all around us. We can't hold things to exact numbers. We'd like to. Your wall socket has 110 volts or 120, whatever, coming out of it. Is it exactly 120 volts? Probably not. You'd think it would be completely ludicrous if you got pulled over by a patrolman And they said, well, you were speeding 0.0001 mile an hour over the speed limit. Not. Intolerances are all around us. We tend to forget about them. You can't do that when you're doing engineering work, because you have to take into consideration the tolerances of everything that you work with to make sure that the tolerance, if they were worst case, if everything went the wrong way, whether or not the circuit would still work. Otherwise, you're going to have some portion of these things as they roll down the assembly line that through no fault of any of the assembly people or any of the other materials and everything, just because the tolerances all worked out the wrong way, the device doesn't work. It's not functional. So you need to bear in mind that these tolerances need to be considered whenever you're engineering. In order to compute the minimum and maximum, I give you sort of an example here. It's not real complicated. If it's a 5% resistor, you say, in this particular case, the target value is 6.2 megohms. You multiply 6.2 megohms times 95%, or 0.95, gives you 5.89 megohms. If you multiply the same number, the 6.2 megohms times 105%, 1.05, you end up with 6.51 megohms. And so those two values, if the resistor is not running out of spec, in other words, if it's a valid resistor, it hasn't been damaged or something, and the factory that made it gave you a resistor that was indeed within tolerance that was stated on the device, and it was a gold-banded device, then you could be assured that the resistance of that resistor is somewhere between 5.89 megohms and 6.51 megohms. It won't be beyond those extremes. If you're building some device, say a timer, for instance, that's relying on that resistor, and you know that that it's supposed to time out in a certain period of time, charging a capacitor or something, you can rely on the rate that it charges that capacitor to be a rate commensurate with those two resistances. So it will affect other things, and when it does, you can predict what the tolerances that it affects them with would be. Okay, moving right along, I give you sort of some memory hints, or memory gimmicks, whatever you want to call them, to help you with trying to memorize the color code itself. The color code consists of the rules that I've shown you with respect to how to read a resistor. It also consists of the notion that you need to somehow memorize, it's a good idea anyway, you need to somehow memorize the colors that are, what each value of the colors represent. They all have a numerical value associated with them. Just getting them into the proper order helps a lot. If you knew what the order of the colors were, maybe you didn't memorize what each value for the colors were, but you at least could put them in order. You could write them down in order. If you could memorize the order of the colors, you could write them down in order and then assign a 0 to the first one and a 1 to the next one and so forth and so on. Okay, so it is getting the order is the tricky part. Whenever I learned this stuff, I never knew about these little memory gimmicks. I just memorized the colors for what they were, kind of one color at a time. I'd be reading a resistor and have to look it up, and eventually it got to the point where I didn't have to look them up anymore. I just pick up a resistor and read the numbers off of it. Read the colors as if they were numbers. You get that way after a while. Trust me. It might not seem like it, but you do. It's something that comes with practice. However, if you're out in the middle of nowhere and you don't happen to have your handy little color chart with you, it'd be nice if you could at least remember how to construct one. These two memory gimmicks are phrases. You take the first word or first letter of each phrase, and you say, okay, that first letter corresponds to a color. And so in the first phrase, for instance, the word bad starts with a B. You have to know that black precedes brown, okay, but that it means, because some of that blue is way down in the color chart, okay, you might not need to know that blue is sixth, but you need to know that blue is way down in the color chart someplace. You read the phrase or memorize the phrase, which isn't too difficult to do. Either of the two phrases work, whichever works best for you, go for it. The first letter of each of the words is the first letter of each of the colors. So bad equates to black, white equates to brown, rape equates to red, etc., etc. You now have the order right. If you can write the colors down in the right order, then assigning numbers to them becomes easy. Don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that, but you should commit this much of it to memory. Also, to commit to memory that gold is more valuable than silver. That's one way you can help to remember it. Gold is 5%, silver is 10%. That seems kind of weird. Gold is more valuable, so why is it a smaller number? Well, because 5% is harder for the manufacturer to achieve. If they're holding really tight tolerances, their yield is lower, so they charge more for the 5%ers than they do for the 10%ers. So gold is more valuable than silver, so it's the 5%, silver's 20%, and hey, no color at all, that's 20%. This much of it you should memorize. As for the next part of it, I don't advise you to memorize the Mantissa values. Okay. Why do you need the Mantissa values? What are the Mantissa values? It makes no sense to specify with the colors. It makes no sense to specify a 5% resistor that is, you're going to manufacture some resistors and you choose a value, you pull a value out of the air. Well, today we're going to make 8.9 k-ohm resistors. And tomorrow we're going to make 9.0k. Gee, that seems like a nice progression. Maybe the day after you'd make 9.1k. Problem is, those numbers are too close together for the 5%, certainly for the 10%. You basically have a lot of overlap. Why make resistors of lots of different values? It tends to do nothing but confuse people who are trying to do this stuff. It requires people that buy your resistors to stock a whole lot more numbers, a whole lot more resistor values, and it becomes... Well, they're not going to buy from you if they can buy from somebody else and only have to stock a tenth as many. So it's impractical to basically have every value of a resistor there is. So what they have done is they have said, okay, for 10% resistors, we're going to choose a set of values that resistors can be. They can't be any other value. If they're 10%ers, they're only going to be these values because these values won't overlap much. And there won't be any gaps between them either. Okay, so they have come up with standard Mantissa values that start at 1.0. That could be 1.0K, 1.0 ohm, 1.0 meg. It can be, you know, anything in between. 100 ohms. 10K. It's a 1.0 kind of thing. Okay, so 1.0 for the first Mantissa value. 1.2 for the next Mantissa value, 1.5 for the next Mantissa value, and so on. Those are the 10% values. Well, okay, that's fine. You could build a whole chart like that with just the 10%ers. One of the things that you figure out real quick is that if you're going to make 5% resistors, there would be gaps between the values. In other words, if you specify 5%, the 10% values, there aren't enough values to... There are gaps between them that are as big as the 5% that you would be using. Okay, so you have twice as many values for the 5% range. So in the case of the 5% one, 1.0 was valid, 1.1 is valid, 1.2 is valid, 1.3 is valid, and so on. I have put those in parentheses in your list there. I advise strongly that you make a chart, put it on your wall, that has the standard 5 and 10% Mantissa values. The 1% Mantissa values you can do if you want. It's up to you. There are so many of them that the reason that there's more is because a 1% resistor, obviously the narrow window is narrower, so you have to have a lot more to fill in. And 1% resistors are read differently than the 5 and 10% resistors are. 1% resistors have three color bands of significance on them. They're three digits, three significant digits. And the fourth band, since it is already a 1% resistor, there's no need to put a 5 or 10% gold or silver, whatever band on there, so they put another color, which is the multiplier. So now they've used up all four bands, and the way you tell a 1% resistor from a 5 or 10% is the 5 or 10% has the gold or no color or silver band. In the case of a 1% resistor, the fourth band is just one of the standard resistor colors. It's the multiplier. So you sit there and you look at this resistor. Oh, wait a minute. This one has a doesn't have a percentage, tolerance band. Wait a minute. Oh, I see. This is a 1% resistor because you can tell because there's four colors on it. There is also on some resistors that have to meet military specifications and other kinds of things. They have what they call a kind of a figure of merit. They say how good the resistor is, how stable it is long term. They say that for a resistor that in the fifth band has a brown band there, it says out of 100 resistors that are running 1,000 hours of these resistors, no more than one will drift out of the spec. If it's 1%, it won't. No more than one of them will drift out of that 1% after 1,000 hours of use. I have seen 5% resistors that had the fifth band, and at the time that I saw the fifth band, I had no earthly idea what it was. a lot of this stuff you learn by doing. If it's a red band, that means that one out of 1,000 resistors of whatever lot of resistors you have, one out of 1,000 of them, no more than one out of 1,000 will drift after 1,000 hours of use. Similarly, an orange, one out of 10,000, and so on. So, it is, it's just a figure of merit. It's not important for most of the stuff. When you get to looking at precision resistors, however, it's an index key, because most precision resistors have that fifth band, and that fifth band is wider, especially on a quarter watts. Quarter watts are such small resistors, it's real difficult to see those resistors anyway. So, I kind of explained to you what the purpose of the Mantissa is, why it's there. Now I need to explain something else. Why do you need it? Why do you care about it? If you are going to order, you're going to design a circuit, and your design works out, you got to have a 4.5 k-ohm resistor. Well, if you send that design out the door and somebody goes down to try and buy a 5% 4.5 k-ohm resistor, they're not going to be able to do it. It's not part of the standard Mantissa values. You should never design a circuit that contains resistors in it that a person can't buy. I don't know why that's a good idea, but, so you refer to the standard Mantissa value and find the closest value to what it is, and then go back through your calculations and see if it's okay to use that resistor in your circuit. If not, you got to do something different to your design. We'll get to that later. Okay. Another thing that knowing the standard Mantissa values is really good for, if you're looking at a piece of equipment that's been that's fried, somebody was using it and all of a sudden it started emitting a strange odor and it didn't work anymore. The instinct of a person that suddenly notices burning phenolic, they don't know what burning phenolic is, but it doesn't smell good. they turn the thing off. And so whenever you get the thing, there's this discolored resistor. It's gotten hot enough that it's vaporized part of the phenolic, or at least fragranted the air. When they get that hot, the body darkens. It goes toward black. In fact, if you leave the unit on, the shorted transistor pumping extra power into that resistor will likely just turn it to carbon. I mean, it just completely crumble away to nothing. I've seen resistors glow yellow hot. Okay, that's not good for phenolic. It tends to cause it to discolor, and the paint for the colored bands is right on top of that phenolic. What do you suppose happens to the paint? Well, it discolors too. So now you've got a resistor who, well, the leads are, they act as heat sinks. Copper wire is conductive, both of electricity and of heat. And whenever the heat goes out of the copper wires, it tends to keep the ends of the body of the resistor cooler than the middle. The middle is glowing yellow hot, whereas the ends are not emitting any light at all. Okay, now, what this means is that a discolored resistor is going to be mostly discolored in the center of the resistor. That's usually where your multiplier band is. Okay, out away from that is the tolerance band, probably discolored, probably not as badly. And the second digit of precision is probably discolored, probably not as badly. The clear on the end is the first digit of precision, and it should be nice and visible. It should probably be unhurt, we'll hope. Okay, unless your resistors completely crumble to dust. If you look at that first color band, that color band will say, okay, this is, say you've determined by looking at the other band, the band at the other end, you've looked at the tolerance band, and you believe that this is a 10% resistor, for instance. Okay, if you believe that this is a 10% resistor, then you can say with a certain degree of certainty that because it's a 10% resistor, and because the first band you believe to be, for instance, a yellow band, you can look at that and say, well, I don't know what the second one is, it's terribly discolored, but because I believe it to be a 10% resistor, and because the first band is a yellow band, it could only be a violet band. You can't see the color. You don't need to see the color. You go to the Mantissa chart, and the only value that could be put in there is 4.7. Okay? So, now you know the first two digits. The multiplier is so badly charged that you really can't tell. It's not even an option. However, if the resistor isn't damaged so badly that you can't read it with a meter, what you do is you read the meter, knowing that the reading that you're going to get is going to be wrong. You accept that. But your reading would have to be off by a factor of 10 for you not to be able to figure out the correct color for the multiplier, because the multiplier is the number of zeros. So if you can get within a factor of 10, and you can kind of guesstimate, knowing that resistors tend to do one of two things. Carbon comp resistors, whenever they're heat stressed, tend to go down in resistance at first, and whenever they're severely heat stressed, they open up. So if it's a mildly heat stressed resistor, you can expect that its value is going to be lower than what it, or its red value on the meter, whenever you hook it up, that value will be lower than it really is. So you can kind of say, well, yeah, you know, fudge a little bit this way, and yeah, within 10 to 1, that's, you know, got to be an orange band or whatever. So you can use the Mantissa chart to piece back together information to tell you what the colors were. Now, that doesn't work very well with 1% resistors because there's too many values. In the case of a 1% resistor, if it was terribly charred and you seen the first band was a yellow, gosh, that The other two bands could be any one of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, about 9, 10, 10 different values. Okay, just for the yellow band. And how are you going to tell what those are? So, 1% resistors, it's not as easy to do this with, but certainly with 5 and 10% resistors, it's fairly easy to do. So you can reconstruct this information by using the Mantissa chart. Mantissa chart is useful. Another reason to use the Mantissa chart is because, okay, some of us are unfortunate enough to be color deficient, one or two colors of the color spectrum. It's a sort of a heredity thing. It also tends to be more common among males. That's just something, that's just a cross we bear. Okay, I am one of these people that is color deficient of red and green, which is probably the most common kind of color deficiency there is. You can get around this problem by using the Mantissa chart. If you are trying to pick a resistor that you know to be a good resistor out of the drawer, and you look at the Mantissa chart, even though you can't tell, can't kind of figure out which of those two colors it is, whether it's a red or a green, the fact that they can only fit in certain slots gives you a real good indication of what the thing is. And most of the time, just knowing, or maybe even memorizing the Mantissa chart, you can look at the resistor and tell what it is, even though you can't really see the colors. Okay, I'm going to point out a technique that I use, being colorblind, or color deficient, that works real well for me in case there's other people out there that run into this problem. If you are in a room where you're bathed in white light, and you have a resistor that you're looking at, or this works even with wires, if you've got colored wires, and you're bathed in white light, and you look at them, and there's these two gray wires... They're not gray. You know they're not gray. And they both are the same shade of gray. You know one of them has to be red and the other one green, probably. But you don't know which is which. If you will take a light source that has a filter on it for red, and you'll bathe that thing in that red light, the red wire will jump right out at you. It'll seem to fluoresce. And the green one won't. If you then bathe it in green light, the other wire, the green one, will appear to fluoresce, and the red one won't. This is because if you bathe it in green light, only the green one will reflect a lot of light. The red one, it doesn't. It's not the right color. It won't reflect it. There's another way to do this if you're in the field and you don't want to carry a bright red light with you all the time. A little color filter that you can hold over your eye, a green filter and a red filter and maybe a blue filter. I don't know. Get carried away with this. There are places that you can go, by the way, for sample plastics that Roscoline is one trade name that comes to mind, where they have this little deck of cards that's sort of got a plastic rivet going through the center of it, and you can kind of fan it out like a deck of cards, and each one of these little pieces of plastic is interleaved with a little piece of paper that says this color is, you know, green number something or other, right? And you can just fan this thing out and hold it up to your eye and look through it, and then alternately take it away and look at it normally. So now you look at it through a green lens and look at it through just no lens at all, and then back to a green lens and back to it. It's the same effect as putting it under green light. Okay? So that's a technique that I use. It's real helpful, and it has enabled me to see what color wires are. So I mention those two things because you're going to run into color-coded stuff all the time in electronics, and you need some way to deal with it. Okay, I should also mention that if you're trying to repair a piece of equipment that's been damaged and you really can't figure out what value that resistor was supposed to be, sometimes a large city library is real helpful. You can go into the science and engineering section of a really well-stocked library, and they have Howard W. Sam's publications, a thing called the PhotoFact series, if you're familiar with this. It's basically schematic diagrams on everything from TVs, VCRs, radios, you name it. Consumer stuff. They don't get into computers that much. They tried for a while. I don't think they're even trying to support that anymore. If you can't find the particular piece of equipment supported by that, sometimes the city library has factory service manuals that they carry. And usually all this stuff is reference material. They won't let you carry it out of the library. You can't, like, check it out or something. But all you really want is just the schematic with all the values on it. And that's just a page or two out of the whole thing. That's all you really care about. Well, most big city libraries have copy machines. Oh, boy. I got myself into it now. call it plagiarism. Fair use. That's a better term. I like fair use better, yes. At any rate. So, that's another thing. In your lab assignment, I mentioned to you that you should try to do your, read your resistors, read the color codes on them, and then compare them against your meter. Doing this, you're going to run into error. You're going to see the error for real. Maybe sometimes more extreme than others, but the readings won't quite agree, and that's the tolerances getting in the way. But it's also other sources of error. Your meter has a thing called parallax error. If it's a mechanical meter, you've got a needle that sweeps across the dial, and as the needle sweeps across the dial, it doesn't touch. It's elevated above it. You know, there are pivot points and everything that kind of hold the whole assembly with a little needle that sweeps across the dial. It doesn't touch. It's raised about a 1/16 of an inch away from the actual dial surface. If you look at it from the left at a steep angle, you're going to read a lower resistance. The ohm scale starts out at the high end of the scale, the right end of the scale and is zero, and the left end of the scale is infinity. If you look at it from a steep left angle, you're going to read a lower resistance than if you were to look at it from a steep right angle, just because the alignment of the needle and the mark on the dial with parallax error, you get to see them from different angles. In the case of first of all, they cut out a hole on some meters, on the better or the more expensive ones. They cut out a hole the shape of a scale, and behind the dial itself is a mirror, and so you can then align the thing so that you don't see a reflection of the needle. Whereas the needle obscures its own reflection, that ensures that you are lined up properly, and that eliminates parallax error. So that's what the mirror scale is for, in case you didn't know. There's frictional errors. The bearings in the assembly aren't perfect, and whenever you make a reading, the needle kind of sweeps up until frictional losses within the bearings kind of stop it. It stops prematurely. If you, the geek of geek technicians all know this, you take your finger or something and you kind of tap the case of the meter a little bit, and it'll kind of shake it a little bit so that the frictional thing is kind of broken free, and the needle will go ahead and settle to its true reading. In fact, whenever I was a kid many, many years ago, as electronic surplus stores had these little devices that were called instrumentation vibrators, and they were literally a little shaker device that was mounted to a piece of instrumentation that was, inside of a panel where a person couldn't tap on it, so that the meter would always read right. So, tapping on your meter is a good thing to do if you want a good reading. Yeah, if you don't want a good reading, I don't know why you're bothering to measure it. Okay, the meter electronics itself is imperfect. The meter electronics, they do their best, but they use, resistances that have tolerances. They use real-world parts here. And if you measure the resistance of a resistor on one scale, and this particular value of resistor, the measurement that you're seeing is equidistant from the center of the meter, in other words, the reading is needle reading on one scale versus another scale is equidistant from the center, at least in theory, there should be no difference. between the two readings. In fact, there is, and it has again to do with the fact that the electronics is imperfect. So even going from one range to the next, you get error. Some people think that if you're going to read a lot of readings, you're going to like chart a graph that's going to cross over several different ranges of your meter for some reason. Whether it be volts or resistance, whatever it is that you're reading, it makes sense to average several readings if they're close to the center of the scale. In other words, if you have to go back and forth between two different ranges, it makes sense to average them, because that'll get rid of some of the abrupt shifts in the data that you're reading back from the meter. So that's something to be concerned with. Anyway, so there are numerous sources of error that can happen just from reading your meter, not to mention, as I've mentioned before, the tolerance of the resistor itself. So to have your reading on your meter disagree with the reading that you take by reading the colors on the resistor is not unusual. If it disagrees by, oh, like 30% or something, that's ridiculous. You've done something wrong, or you have a bad component, or your meter is broken. But it should be reasonably close, but not right on the money. So expect this. This is also an exercise in how error really exists in the real world. It gets you familiar with this sort of thing. Okay, all these things can come together to produce a worst-case scenario. And the worst-case scenario has to be something that you engineer for. You anticipate that resistances won't be what they're supposed to be, and you design your circuit so that sloppy tolerances of resistors will still produce a working circuit, a circuit that will do what it's supposed to do, even if everything is off in the worst possible way. You could have some resistors that are off one direction and other resistors in the bottom leg of a circuit that are off in the other direction, and come together to produce a situation where things are what they call a worst-case scenario. You design for that. You plan on that. And if you do so, and you do a good job of it, maybe it means that you have to add a whole extra stage of amplification to keep things within a workable range. But if you do that, you'll end up with a circuit that is reproducible in a factory setting. If you fail to do that, the circuit, whenever you build it, might work on the bench. But you build another one sitting right beside it, and it might not work. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this, and on to the next phase.